Oh.
But I think it will go. We did most of it, and I know that Chris knows all the whole thing, and he helped me a lot. And one of the students actually, you know, he got through everything. The other two, I think, they got through at least C. And two other, I think,
okay. Well, that at least is something that you can look up proofs, you know, in virtually any theoretical computer science book. Well, any basic theoretical computer science. The advanced books will assume that you already know it well. But okay. So then I guess we move on to any questions that those few of you who are here might have on what we've been doing. No? No questions yet? OK. So so where were we? So yesterday, I was talking about mostly about classical complexity theory. Actually, I guess everything I said was in some sense classical. But a lot of the motivation, remember, for the way we define things in complexity theory, why we talk about, say, polynomial time as a sensible class rather than, you know, time n squared, was motivated by the idea that we didn't want it to be too dependent on the details of how we encode the information and the details of exactly how our computer worked. So today, I want to examine that assumption a little more closely. And it turns out not to be totally validated. And then we'll move on and start talking about some actual concrete algorithms. So, okay. So in particular, I mentioned yesterday this idea of something called a Turing machine, which is kind of the standard basic model of what a computer is. And I'm not going to go into details of exactly how you define a Turing machine, but basically, it's supposed to capture in some intuitive way what a computer is supposed to do. And of course, it's not a real computer. It has to work on arbitrarily large problems. So it needs some sort of infinite memory. But other than that, it while in detail it doesn't look at all like what a computer does, in practice it seems to represent pretty well the class of problems that a computer can compute. But one of the things that was found when Turing machines were first defined was that that not all problems, not all languages in particular, can be decided at all. Okay. So many languages can be decided. But there's also many languages cannot be decided on a Turing machine. So in particular, the first problem that was proved undecidable and still probably the most famous one is the halting problem. If somebody gives you a computer program, gives you the code for a computer program, you'd like to know whether this program runs forever or whether it halts after a given time on a particular input. So of course, it could run forever by just going into an infinite loop and it does the same thing over and over again. Or it could be some more complicated thing that doesn't loop, right? Like it could be just constantly adding one. And so it just counts 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and that can keep on going forever. Or it could halt after some finite time and output the answer, hopefully, to whatever this problem is. And it turns out that there's no algorithm for determining which of these happens. And there's kind of a nice proof. Again, I'm not going to get into that, of of why this is, where you use a kind of recursive definition. It's you suppose there was such an algorithm, then you feed it its own program code. And that gives you a contradiction. But the reason I bring this up is because, well, you have to ask, well, these languages can't be decided on a Turing machine, but maybe if we define some other kind of machine, it could decide these languages. And to a certain extent, that's true. You can define some artificial computer. For instance, you could say it's a Turing machine, but it also has the ability to answer the halting problem. It has, there's some oracle it can ask. I haven't defined oracles yet. I'll do that in a minute. So some oracle can ask that when it asks a question, when you ask it a question, it just outputs the answer, okay, for this particular problem, the halting problem. Okay? And you can define such a machine, but it's not a very realistic machine, right? Because we have no conceivable way of building such a thing. We don't know anything that can answer the halting problem. And so this machine that you defined would only be a formal thing, not a physically realistic machine. Turing machine is, again, not physically realistic because it has an infinite memory, but it's kind of a sensible extrapolation of a physically realistic thing. And it's by studying all sorts of different kind of more well-motivated definitions than this artificial one, you can come up with a lot of different kind of physically plausible definitions of what a computer could be. But it turns out that they all can decide the same set of languages. So that idea became known as the Church-Turing thesis. And what the Church-Turing thesis says is just that, that all physically realistic models of computation have the same set of decidable languages. Okay? Now, of course, you can make up some physically realistic but very weak models of a computer that can decide fewer languages, right? You could have a Turing machine that only counts, right? And then just doesn't really decide anything. Or maybe it counts down, and so it can decide some very, very simple things. But anything that kind of physically captures the conceptual notion of a universal computer will have the same set of decidable languages. Yeah?
This seems to put like a large constraint on the set of decidable languages.
Certainly even if you just fix a Turing machine, there's many, many languages that are not decidable. In some sense, probably most languages are not decidable.
I guess because the strings have lengths, you can't just do that. But like, you have the set of bit strings, and suppose I have a way to scramble up that set.
Mm-hmm.
So I can never, if the Turing thesis is right, it seems like I can never scramble up that set so that a language which was decidable becomes, like, gets sent into one that is undecidable.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Right. So yesterday I defined the notion of reduction. The way I defined it was that the function that mapped you from one thing to another had to be computable in polynomial time. So if you try to do this for something that kind of mapped a decidable language to an undecidable language, or vice versa, what you'd find is that the function that did it not only is not computable in polynomial time, it's not computable at all. Right? So it might be that for some particular input bit strings, this program would terminate and give you a well-defined output. But for other bit strings, probably what would happen would be it would run and run and run and run and run and never terminate. And of course, because the halting problem is undecidable, kind of the question of which inputs will give you a well-defined output and which ones will not is itself not decidable. And the problem is that some will terminate, but after a very, very long time. And there's no bound, there's no upper bound on the time it would take. That's the typical kind of thing that happens if you try to do this type of mapping. Okay? So anyway, but when we talk about complexity theory, so this Church-Turing thesis does really seem to be true. But when we talk about complexity theory, we'd like to say something more, right? We'd like to say not just that all physically realistic models of computation have the same set of decidable languages, but moreover that what can be computed efficiently on the different types of machines is all the same. So the class P then would not be, you know, I should be more careful. So the class of polynomial time computable functions doesn't depend on what kind of machine you're computing them on. The class P is specifically defined on a Turing machine, so that's of course well defined. But we'd like to say that class P represents the polynomial time things on any physically realistic machine. And so there's kind of an extension of this Church-Turing thesis, which is kind of part of the folklore of theoretical computer science. It goes by some different names, for instance, the strong Church-Turing thesis, or the modern Church-Turing thesis, or things like that. And that says, well, what I just said, that all physically realistic models of computation let's rephrase. So all physically realistic models of computation can simulate each other using polynomial resources. So for instance, if you have a gate network that computes some function, you can convert it into a Turing machine that runs in a time that's polynomial in the size of the gate network and computes the same thing. So in particular, these models of computation have the same class of polytime computable functions. Okay. Okay. And so this is kind of the thing that gives teeth to the idea of these complexity classes I talked about yesterday being the right ones to think about, right? Because it means that they're robust against definition of the machine. So if you have a class, you know, P prime that you define as the functions which are computable in polynomial time on some other model of computation, well, then strong Church-Turing thesis says that as long as this other model of computation is a physically reasonable one, then P prime could be equal to P. And similarly for NP and X, which are the other ones I defined yesterday. Okay? So actually, there's even when you stick with classical computation, there's some small crack in this Church-Turing thesis. There's a class called a BPP, which is randomized classical computation with polynomial time and some other technical assumption. And we don't really know whether BPP is equal to P, right? So it might be that having extra randomness in your computation helps you compute additional functions. There's no really kind of good example right now of a problem that's in BPP and not in P. And I think most people, for that reason and for other complexity theoretic reasons, think that they're the same. But that's something that's still open. But quantum computing is a much bigger challenge. And most people who are knowledgeable about quantum computing, I think, don't believe that quantum computing fits into the Church-Turing thesis. So in particular, this thing is probably false. Because quantum computers probably can't be efficiently simulated . So let me define the analogous class of polynomial time computable functions on a quantum computer. And the most natural one is called BQP, for bounded quantum polynomial. And that's the class of languages L, such that there exists polytime quantum algorithm A of X that. So first, if x is in the language, then A of x accepts with probability greater than or equal to 2/3. And if x is not in the language, A of x rejects with probability at least 2/3. OK. So quantum algorithm is when you run the algorithm at the end, you measure it, and you get an answer. And of course, that answer is going to have some randomness potentially in it, right? Because it's a quantum state, and the measurement could have some probability of either outcome. So that's why we need these probabilities in here. And we'd like to say that that with a when the string is in the language, then accepts with high probability. It says yes with high probability. And if it's not in the language, then it says no with high probability. Right? So that when we run this algorithm, we measure, we get the right answer with some reasonable confidence. Now, these actual numbers, 2/3 here, that doesn't really matter. Okay? If instead you used 4/5 or 0.9999999, you get the same complexity class. And the reason for that is we can repeat to amplify the probability, right? So if we do this 3 times and we take the majority, right, then let's see. So what's the probability then? So it's kind of about, I guess it's kind of about more on the order of 1/9. It's not quite right. There's some combinatoric factor in there that you get the wrong answer instead of 1/3. Anyway, the point is that by repeating and taking the majority, you can get more and more confidence, and you can make this probability as high as you like. In fact, it gets exponentially close to 1 with number of repetitions. And so these two things do need to be bigger than 1/2, right? If it's exactly 1/2, then you're not getting any information. It's just random. And if it's 1/2 plus something very, 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 very small, then repeating it, you'll have to repeat it a whole lot of times before you can get any difference. But if this is a constant, then you're fine. And in fact, if it's something that's 1/2 plus something polynomially small, then you still even get the same class. But the main thing is just there needs to be some really distinct separation between the yes instances and no instances so that you can statistically, you can gather enough information as to which one is right. Okay? So let me draw a picture of the complexity classes we have so far. So we started with P. So these are the things that are computable in polynomial time on a classical computer. And then we had a big class called X, which was exponential time on a classical computer. And then there was NP, which remember the things that can be checked in polynomial time on a classical computer. And we know that P is inside NP, right? Because certainly if you can compute it by yourself in polynomial time, you don't need any help from a witness to answer the, whether it's a yes instance or no instance. It's perhaps less obvious that NP is inside X. But the easy way to see that is, well, we know there exists a witness that's only polynomial size in the instance, the description of the instance. So what we could do is we could just try every possible witness. Right? And if we do that and we get a yes, then we know that it's a yes instance. And if we do that and they all reject, then we know that it's a no instance. And so trying every possible witness, that's going to take exponential time. But that's enough to prove that NP is inside X. Okay. And then BQP, well, BQP probably looks something like this. Oh, I can say, and of course, we believe that NP is not equal to P. So there's some things that are in NP that are not in P. We actually know we can prove that P is not equal to X. But we can't prove that P is not equal to NP. And then, so BQP, this is the relationship that we believe it has to the others. Let me write this so you can see it better. So BQP certainly includes P. And that's because, well, whether we use irreversible classical computation or reversible classical computation doesn't matter. Right, that really does fall under the strong Church-Turing thesis. And so that's what we discussed on the very first day. And then a quantum computer can simulate any reversible computation. So certainly anything that we can do on a reversible classical computer, and therefore on an irreversible classical computer, can be done on a quantum computer. So P is included in BQP. It's also less obvious that BQP is inside X. But it's not too hard to show that. And the way you show that is you just say, well, any quantum computation is a big unitary operation acting on 2 to the n dimensional Hilbert space. And so what we can do is we can just take the matrix for this 2 to the n by 2 to the n unitary and multiply it out. Every time we add a new gate, we multiply it in. And that will take exponential time because it's an exponentially large Hilbert space. But it's certainly doable. Okay, so that proves that BQP is inside X. It's actually, you know, there's lots of other complexity classes that have been defined in here. And if you go to the complexities view, you can see way more of these complexity classes than you'd ever possibly want to know. And so we can set some kind of tighter bounds on the relationship of these things. But in any case, so we believe that BQP includes some problems that are in NP but not in P. So it has this intersection here. But that it also includes some problems that are not in NP. And we believe that the NP complete problems are not in BQP. And so I'll show you an example of a problem that's in here tomorrow, probably. I guess, probably in the tutorial on Thursday, you'll do a problem that's probably out here. And in class on Thursday and Friday, probably, I'll give you some evidence that there are problems, NP complete problems, for instance, that are here that are in NP but not in BQP. Okay. None of these is really, you know, really, certainly none of them is really a proof. We can't prove that these things are different. But, you know, there's enough room for doubt on all of these things. But this is, I think, the consensus. Yeah.
Is P in BQP?
P is in BQP, yeah. Because anything you can do on a classical irreversible computer, you can do with a reversible computer. And that you can simulate using quantum gates. Or just do it kind of using quantum gates. Yeah?
So you said that it's known that X is outside of P.
Yeah.
So how do you show that there's no polynomial time algebra for a problem?
Okay. Sorry, I haven't really looked at that proof recently. Do you know offhand?
That's what Savage is.
Maybe, yeah.
I forget. It's
yeah, okay. And there's basically you can define some sort of artificial problem. The way this type of argument works, you define some sort of artificial problem that. Actually, maybe this is just a counting. Yeah, sorry, I don't remember. Maybe I can look it up and get back to you. Basically, you define some either it's a non-constructive proof, and you just say there's not enough possible polynomial time algorithms.
Okay.
Well, that's one possible argument that we use to separate things. And the other possible argument is you define some sort of artificial problem that by some sort of recursive argument, that kind of like the proof of that halting is undecidable.
So they didn't like take some problem that people were already interested in and then show that there was no possible follow-up?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that X is one of those classes that has kind of natural complete problems either. But there's some even bigger classes. Well, anyway, there's an infinite hierarchy of complexity classes, and basically whenever you blow up by an exponential, we can finally prove that there's separation. But other than that, we can't really do anything. Yeah.
You mentioned both classes. You don't really need to assume the witness grows polynomially with the size of the problem.
Right.
So how does this proof that X is bigger than P or NP to go through? Like.
Oh well. So the reason you don't need to prove it is because you can derive the fact that the witness doesn't need to be more than polynomially bigger, right? Well, if the verification circuit runs in polynomial time in the instance size, then it can't use more than it can't look at more than polynomially many bits of the witness anyway.
Need to be. Oh, so there can be many witnesses.
Right. So there could be you know. Okay. Right. So you could have a much longer witness that you just ignore most of it. But yes, the witness definitely does not have to be unique.
Okay.
And you can see that in satisfiability, right? That some formulas have more than one satisfying assignment. Of course, in that case, it doesn't make sense to talk about a witness that's bigger than the number of variables. But in some other problems, maybe. Okay? Okay. So, so much for complexity theory. One way that at one point people wanted to try to prove separations between these different classes was to kind of abstract out the details of computation and just think of something called oracles. Well, I don't know if it's worth really calling this formal definition, but an oracle is kind of a black box. And it just computes some function. And most of the time we deal with oracles that have a binary output. And the idea is we have no idea how this oracle computes this function. That's why it's a black box. Just some black box, we ask it a question, it gives us an answer. For all we know, it could be magic. Okay? And then the idea is there's a complexity theoretic model associated with these oracles where we can talk about the query complexity. So what we'd like to do is we'd like to compute some function of the oracle. And that's the minimum number of oracle calls required to determine half of them. Okay, so this can be done in a lot of different contexts. So for instance, you can say, we'll let the oracle be absolutely anything. And then we want to know the minimum number of oracle calls required to always compute f of o, no matter what o is. Or you can say o has some restrictions on it, called a promise. And then we want to compute f of o in that case. Or you can say, well, we're allowing some randomness, and we want to compute it with high probability. Or, of course, in the quantum case, we can make a quantum version of the oracle. And then we want to compute on a quantum computer. Well, how many queries on a quantum computer needed to determine f of o? Let's see. So the thing to remember is that in this query complexity model, it doesn't matter what we do in between oracle calls. Okay, we can do arbitrarily complicated computations. Now we can use lots and lots of memory. We can you know, compute the solution to some NP-complete problem. We can do whatever we like. But since we're trying to compute information about the oracle, right, even though we can compute arbitrarily complex things, that doesn't necessarily tell us anything new about the oracle. Right? So there's just kind of an information theoretic flavor to this type of question. Is there's this mysterious area. And every time we make a query, we get some information out of it. Okay? And then we can do whatever processing we want on that information. But that doesn't generate new information by itself. It just lets us better figure out how to use the information that we've gotten. And then we can maybe ask another query and get some more information. And so what we'd like to do is work out how best to ask questions to extract the most possible information that helps us determine f of o. Right? So we don't necessarily need to determine exactly what o is, although sometimes that's what f of o is asking for. But we want to compute some particular property of o. Yeah.
It seems like you probably wouldn't have this in most practical situations.
Yeah, so this is not realistic. This is an abstraction. So there's two motivations for it. So one is people originally started studying these as a way kind of hoping to be able to prove separations between complexity classes to prove that, say, for instance, P is not equal to NP. And it turns out that doesn't work. For reasons that I don't want to get into. But the other thing is that they're good simplifications of algorithms as well. And the reason is, well, suppose you have some function that you do know how to compute, okay? And you have an algorithm that works on a black box version of that function and tells you f of o. So for instance, this is an example that we'll deal with in a couple of days. But suppose you have a Boolean formula, right? And you'd like to compute a satisfying assignment for that Boolean formula. Okay, so that's this f of o. So o then is, well, I plug some variables in. So the input is the variable assignment. And the output is, does these variables satisfy or not? Okay. And then what we'd like to compute f of o is what is a satisfying assignment for this formula. OK, so that's then not a function. It's kind of a random function, because there might be multiple possible answers. But let's say there's a unique answer. And so the function is then, what is a satisfying assignment? So if I have an algorithm that works on a black box function of, I'm given some variables, it says yes or no, and it extracts a satisfying assignment out of that, well, it'll certainly work if we have extra information and we know how to compute this function. Okay? So that's what it's useful for. And I'll, like I said, I'll get back to that in a couple of days when we talk about Grover's algorithm. Let me write down first what I said. Other computational resources don't count. So of course, this is a big caveat of what I said about using these oracle algorithms to get other algorithms, right? If you're using, you know, a ridiculous amount of computation to process the information you're getting out of the oracle, then it's not such a useful algorithm. But if the other computational resources are reasonable in this particular algorithm you came up with, then you can put it together with an algorithm for extracting information and maybe get something that's actually useful. Yeah?
Why is f written as a function of, like, what does that notation mean?
So the point is that there's many possible oracles, right? And actually, this is probably even not the right way to do it, because you want a family of oracles that works for different input sizes. So this is just kind of an approximate version. But what you'd like to know is, so some of those oracles will have one property, some will have another property. Why don't I give an example, actually? Since that's the next thing I was going to do anyway. So let's consider oracles which fit one of two classes. So this is either a constant function, and what that means is that O of x is equal to O of y. So either it always outputs 0, it always outputs 1. Or it's a balanced function. And what that means is that if you look at the set of x such that O of x equals 0, that set has the same size as a set of x such that O of x equals 1. Okay? So balanced function has the same number of 0 outputs as 1 outputs. Okay? So there's lots of functions. Well, there's only two constant functions, but there's lots and lots of balanced functions. Okay, and so so our oracle problem is given an oracle O from this family, determine whether it's constant or balanced. Okay, so that's the function of the oracle that I was talking about here. You have this big set of possible oracles. Two of them are constant functions, and the rest of them are balanced functions. Okay, so that's kind of a one-bit output, 0 for constant, 1 for balanced. So given any oracle, if you have a full description of the oracle, well, then you can look at that description and say which of these is the case. Okay. So this is basically just some terminology for saying we want to compute some property of the oracle. Okay, so if you think about this, if you just make one query to this oracle, well, that's not going to give you any information, right? Because, I mean, it'll give you information, but it's not going to tell you which of these two things we have. Right, because this thing is comparing values from different queries of the oracle. So if you make two queries, well, if you get different answers, well, certainly that tells you it's a balanced function. But if you get the same answer, well, you don't really know. Maybe it's more likely that it's a constant function. Okay, but it's still possible it's a balanced function. You just happen to pick two that gave the same answer. And if you make three queries, well, it's kind of the same thing is going on. It's, again, more likely that it's a constant function, but it's possible that you just happen to pick three things that give the same answer, and it's actually balanced. And as you add more and more queries, well, if you chose those queries randomly, then it seems more and more likely, if you always get the same answer, that it's a constant function. But to be absolutely sure, completely sure which one, well, you have to make 2 to the n minus 1. Plus 1, I guess. Right? Because the balance function, well, these things are both equal, and they comprise everything. So there's this size is actually 2 to the n minus 1. And so if you only ask 2 to the n minus 1 queries, it might have been that you just happened to pick every single thing that's in this set. And that's why you always got 0. Okay, again, if you're doing it randomly, that's not at all likely. But it's possible. It's possible. So to be absolutely sure, you have to make 2 to the n minus 1 plus 1 queries. And then if you always get 0, then you really know that it's always that it's definitely a constant function. Okay? So if you're willing to accept some probability of failing, well, then you can use a randomized algorithm, as I said, and then you need about a log n, well, log 2 to the n, so about order n queries. Okay. Yeah.
Does that depend on what your acceptable fail probability is?
Yeah, it does. So in particular, a randomized algorithm needs O of n queries to succeed with constant probability. So as in the case of BQP, if we're talking about randomized algorithms, we should have a separation away from a half. Right? So if, say, you just want to succeed with probability 2/3, you want to get the right answer with probability 2/3, then you need O of n queries. Now, if you want to succeed with probability 1 minus e to the minus n square, then you're going to need more queries. But it's actually still just going to be polynomial. It'll be n cubed, something like that. OK? So everyone see this. And this is not, I guess, a formal proof, but it's certainly the right answer. Yeah?
Do you mind if I jump to Ben a little bit and ask how a quantum algorithm would do with this?
Well, I don't mind. That was, of course, the next thing I was going to do. But I want to make sure that people have no more questions on this before I do that. Yeah?
Maybe you can tell me whether this is like thinking about things in the correct way. Can you think of the gates in your computer at home as like oracles for functions like AND and NOT?
You can. I don't think that's a particularly helpful way to do it. And the reason is that AND and NOT are such very simple things. It's not very helpful to think of them as black boxes. Because we know how they work, we know what they do. A better example, is if you have a more complicated computer program. And let's imagine that picture where you've just bought this computer program, you've installed it on your computer. You don't really know exactly what it does or how it works. You kind of maybe know roughly what it does. But you'd like to figure out exactly what it does, or exactly how to do some particular task with it. And so your goal is to figure that out. Right, you don't know the source code. I mean, in principle, you could, dig into the guts of your computer's memory and read that source code and try to figure out from that what the program does. But that seems like a lot of work. That's not really what you want to do. Instead, what you want to do is try stuff on this program and see what happens. And based on that, you'll try to deduce exactly what this program is actually doing. That's kind of the model of what this Oracle model is working. Yeah?
It seems like, at least for this particular example, they're trying to compute something which, in the continuum case, would be something topological or function.
No, I mean, it doesn't have to be topological. Again, it's
something more global rather than.
Yeah, so it could be a global property. In this case, it definitely is a global property. It doesn't have to be a global property, right? It could be that you just want to know something that's more local. The reason I picked this particular example partly is because it's a global property. And in particular, that means that it's something that's hard to compute deterministically on a classical computer. But it turns out on a quantum computer, which in some sense can access global information in a different way, is actually easy to compute. So I didn't. This is not just a random example. This is one of really the first quantum algorithm, or one of the first quantum algorithms. Okay. So why don't I show you that? So first, I have to tell you what a quantum oracle looks like. And so, given any classical oracle. We can define a quantum oracle that works like this. Well, so it's going to take two inputs, and one of them is going to be the query string, the string that we're plugging into the oracle. And the other one, well, let's say it's A. So this is our ancillary qubit, but it's going to be the output of the oracle. And then the oracle will leave X as X, and then A. Well, it'll look like A plus O of X, right? So this just is the same way that we make classical functions reversible, right? We keep a copy of the input, and we XOR, or kind of control not, the output into some auxiliary bit. And of course, if you put a 0 in here, then you get out exactly O of X. But the thing that makes this a quantum oracle is that we can do this on superpositions. Okay. So, so then this constant balance problem we can solve with the following algorithm. This is called the Deutsch-Jose algorithm. I always forget how to spell. I did not write down the spellings of their names, but I think that's correct. So anyway, so it looks like this. So we're going to take one input register, which starts as all zeros. Okay, and then we do the Hadamard transform on all of those. And then we have another register which is going to calculate the answer to our oracle. And we apply O. Okay? And then we do a phase shift gate down here. And then we apply O again. And finally, we do Hadamard transforms on these qubits again. And measure. And my claim is that if we get all zeros, well, this is not a claim, this is the algorithm. If we get all zeros, we conclude it's a constant function. And otherwise, we conclude it's a balanced function. Okay? So I realize these H's are small. They're Hadamard transforms on all of these qubits. Other than that, does everyone understand what the circuit is? This Z is a phase shift gate, right? It's the poly Z, so it's this matrix. Okay, so so let's analyze this and see why this works. So first, let's do the constant case. So in the constant case, well, let's see. So we start out with all zeros. Then we do the Hadamard transform. And the Hadamard transform converts 0 to 0 plus 1. Right? So if we do the Hadamard transform on all of these n qubits, well, we'll have a superposition of every possible bit string, zeros or ones, in every possible place, in every combination. So what we have, we can write it as sum over x of all x, and then the ket x. And then that tensor 0. Okay? And then we do the oracle. Okay? What does the oracle do? Well, it computes O of x, and it adds this to this. But it's the same for all x. Well, okay. So in this part so far doesn't depend on being constant. For any x, it computes O of x, and it adds it to 0, so you just get 0 plus O of x is O of x. So in general, if oracle were totally arbitrary, this could be an entangled state. But since it's a constant function, this is always the same, and we get sum over x of x. There should be a normalization here, of course. Tensor, well, O of some, you know, some constant value, say 0. Okay? And then we do a phase shift on this. So that gives us, in this case, it gives us a global phase, right? Because it's doing the same thing to all of these. So we get minus 1 to the O of 0, and then sum over x, tensor O of 0. And then we undo the oracle, which erases this. And then we do the Hadamard transform. And what does the Hadamard transform do? Well, on sum over x of x, that's, you know, the tensor product of 0 plus 1 on every qubit. So it takes 0 plus 1 back to 0. And so this becomes all zeros again. Okay? So indeed, and this global phase, of course, has no significance. We measure, we always get all zeros. So indeed, if we have a constant function, we always get all zeros. And so at least if we have a constant function, we'll get the right answer when we run this algorithm. Does everyone understand all the steps of this analysis? Yeah.
If you just look at that diagram over there, it seems like this circuit can't do anything because you put in, you know, you put in a superposition, all ones and all zeros.
Right.
It goes through, and then you de-Hadamard. Oh wait, is that Hadamard gate its own?
Well, this Z gate is actually very, very important. Okay. Now you're right. In the constant case, it seemed like we didn't do anything because for the constant oracle, because we did the oracle, then we undid it, and we did Hadamard. And the Hadamard is, in fact, its own inverse. So it seems like you just reversed itself. But you'll see when I do the balance case that this Z gate actually does something. And the thing is that the Z does not commute with this oracle. Okay, and that's really important. And that's why these things don't just always annihilate. Why don't I do the balance case and you can see that. But are there questions on the constant case? Or, you know, the definition of the circuit or anything like that.
those oracles and known circuits to make new oracles?
Yes and no. I mean, so what you call an oracle and what you call a known circuit is totally up to you. The property of an oracle is that you don't know what's going on inside it. So if you take a known circuit, or a known circuit plus an oracle, or whatever, and then just ignore all the information you had about how it was constructed, then it'll be like an oracle. I should say, though, that in these oracle problems, typically it's, you know, some particular oracle that we want to find information. You're not allowed to make up your own one and replace the original one. That would be cheating. OK, so let's do the balance case. So in that case, again, we start with all zeros. We do the Hadamard. We get sum over x of x. That's 0. And then we apply the oracle. And so we get this again, but now it's not a tensor product. Now it really is an entangled state. Okay? And the reason is because sometimes, for some values of x, we get a 0 here, and for some values, we get a 1. Okay? So that means that when we apply the phase shift, we actually get a different state. We get minus 1, the O of x, x tensor, O of x. And then the next step, well, we undo the oracle. So on a basis state, it'll take x, O of x. It'll add O of x to the second register, so that erases the O of x. We have sum over x of minus 1 to the O of x, x. And then that's tensor 0. Okay, and this, you see, is a different state than this sum over x that we started with. And in fact, this state is orthogonal to the all zero state. Sorry, not to the all zero state, to the superposition of everything state. Right? Well, how do you see that? Well, you take the inner product, and this is a balanced function, right? Which means that the number of zeros is equal to the number of ones. So for 2 to the n minus 1 values, we have a plus 1 here. And for 2 to the n minus 1, we have a minus 1. So when we take the inner product of this with this, well, the plus 1s and the minus 1s cancel out. Okay? That's why it's orthogonal. And that means that when we do the Hadamard transform on this state, we have to get, well, we don't know what we get exactly. We get some state psi. But psi is orthogonal to the Hadamard transform of the superposition of everything, which is the all zero state. So that means this state psi is orthogonal to the all zero state. And so if we measure in the computational basis, we could get anything except all zeros. Right? And what that means is that this is correct, too. That if we get a balanced function, we'll never get all zeros. We'll get something else. And so we'll reach the right conclusion. Okay. So this is a quantum algorithm that solves this constant balanced oracle problem with just two queries, as opposed to the classical case. And it works 100% of the time, as opposed to the classical case where we needed 2 to the n minus 1 plus 1 queries to solve the same problem. Of course, this is an artificial problem. No one's actually interested in distinguishing between constant and balanced oracles. But it demonstrates, at some level, the fact that quantum computers can solve some kinds of problems much faster than a classical computer. So actually, it turns out you can even make a quantum algorithm that works with one query. And you'll do that in the tutorial today. And then tomorrow, I'll I probably won't finish with Troy's algorithm, but I'll talk about the most famous quantum algorithm, which actually solves a problem that people really are interested in. So I'll start by talking about why people are interested in that, and talk about RSA cryptography, and then go on to the quantum factoring algorithm. Okay, but are there questions on this stuff?
If you put in any input in the computational basis to that oracle,
right.
The X coming out can't depend on what the oracle said.
Sorry, this register.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is just supposed to be for classical input, this is just supposed to be a copy of the input.
Right. So it's also not clear to me that if X is in the computational basis and A is just some arbitrary state, it's not clear to me that in that case, X can then depend on, like,
sorry, if X is in the computational basis and A is some arbitrary state.
Like,
so if A is a superposition.
Yeah, maybe I should just do it in my head, maybe that's why and see why it won't work. But like, if you have X and then like 0 plus 1.
Right.
So you have X0, X1.
Yeah.
You send them both through the oracle and you're doing like controlled.
Right. So like, what you have in that case, well, you start, say, you have start with alpha X0 plus beta x1, something like this, right? And you go through, you get alpha x o of x plus beta x1 plus o of x, right? But you see, you still have x in the first register. So that's
right.
X tensor alpha o of x plus beta 1 plus o of x.
Okay.
Okay? So it's only if you have a superposition on the first qubit that something more interesting happens. Well, do the tutorial today, because that plays with this very issue, and maybe by fiddling that you can get a better understanding. And if not, then we can talk about it tomorrow. Okay. Okay.
Very good.